Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. You know, the Crave family is best known, I think, for its dairy operations in Waterloo, Wisconsin. That's where they produce Crave Brothers Homestead cheese, which I have some in my refrigerator as we speak. Carl Crave with us today contributed to the family business by building its first biodigester. He now serves as Vice President of Operations for Dynamic Renewables, and this is a Wisconsin-based company. It specializes in producing renewable gas and other products from the manure that's provided by many dairy farms here in the state and elsewhere, Iowa as well, for example. As we talk with him about recycling and biodigesters, I hope you'll join in the conversation. What questions do you have about recycling manure? Give us a call. Number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Carl Crave, welcome. Thanks for joining in today.
Good morning, Larry. Happy to be here on a much warmer day than Mark Crave's visit last week.
Yeah. You're a member, you know, this is the third generation farm business. Mark talked a bit about it last week. You, the Crave Brothers Farm and Cheese Factory in Waterloo, I think it supports, in a way, seven family members. And probably a lot more people as well.
And I don't even think I was on that list, Larry. But yeah, my wife works at the cheese factory. She's been there for pushing 20 years now. And yeah, it is a growing business. And part of what they've been successful with, I think, is different family members have the ability to find what they enjoy. And if that happens to be at the farm or the cheese factory or in a related field, that's a positive thing. And my little slice of that is the biodigester manure handling system. And that's kind of how I got involved in my own business, which is separate from the families. But that's how I got started 20 years ago.
What made you want to set up that? And it's the first biodigester on the family farm.
Yeah, it was the first one. And about 20 years ago, I was finishing up some school here at UW-Madison. And the farm was in some pretty good planning in terms of growth. So they were planning the cheese factory had just gotten started. They were planning to add some more cows, some more barns. And part of that was kind of looking at their manure handling system. And my dad, Charlie, who's just recently retired, at that time was kind of taking a broader look at how they're going to expand the farm long-term and be sustainable long-term. And part of that was manure handling. They had to be adding cows. They had to be building some manure infrastructure. They had to be kind of taking a broader look at things. So my dad had a friend, I think from college as well, that actually had a manure digester at their farm many years ago. So it's something that he had on his radar, but was still fairly new in Wisconsin. At that time, there was maybe a handful on farms in Wisconsin and hundreds, if not thousands, in Europe. So kind of started researching with him. And spent some time looking at what Europe was doing, especially Germany at the time. And there was a couple of German companies that had just kind of gotten into the U.S. market. And that kind of piqued our interest. And we started visiting other farms that had digesters, spent some time looking at Europe, what they were doing, and kind of realized that for him to really maximize the energy and be as efficient as possible, that was a key component to their strategy. So that's kind of where the interest started.
And so you got it going.
Kind of finished school, took a little leap of faith with some new equipment vendors from Europe, and
away we went.
And I kind of learned the hard way, and I was the operator. I helped design it, construct it, and eventually operate it for a few years. Yeah, it was in hindsight, that was 20 years ago. It was a golden opportunity for me personally to learn hands-on, and I'm a mechanical guy, and I enjoyed the learning by failure. We did a lot of that.
So this is an anaerobic digester, it's called, and people are wondering, well, how does it work?
Sure. So quite often we refer to the entire facility as a digester, but the real key component essentially is a large tank. and it's sealed from outside air, so therefore it's anaerobic without oxygen. And when you pump organic matter, whether it's manure or food waste or anything organic, you can pump into that digester. We heat it to about 100 degrees, and there's natural bacteria in the manure that break down the food, the energy that's left in that manure, and that creates biogas. So that enclosed tank, the digester, creates biogas, and which is mainly methane. So no different than the methane we pull out of the ground and run in our stoves and ovens at home and heat our water with. So we capture that methane gas, we clean that up, and then becomes our fuel source for, could be fuel to run an engine and create energy, or it could be used for transportation fuel in natural gas-powered vehicles.
John wants to know, does it reduce manure odor?
It does. That's probably one of the largest benefits of an anaerobic digester. So as we're reducing the organics, those volatile organics is what we're smelling. So mm-hmm. in the summer, especially when you drive by a farm and you have that odor, that's, or if they're land applying on their ground, that volatile organics is what you're smelling. So when we put it in the digester, our goal is to harvest those volatile organics. So the one of the main benefits to a dairy is it breaks down a great deal of the odor.
Yeah. So aside from odor, what are the environmental benefits of recycling dairy farm manure?
So a lot of the farms also use that as part of a process to create bedding back on their farms. So a digester does not eliminate the volume, but it does convert it to much more usable products. So one of those products that is often created is animal bedding. So dairy cows especially like a nice soft bed to lay in.
Mm-hmm.
So it will actually take some of the byproduct that comes out of the digester and squeeze that out, and it kind of leaves a fibrous product that the farmers will put back under their cows. So bedding is quite often a byproduct, and then the nutrients that come out of the digester are better available to the crops for growing their crops. So they still go back on the field. A little less odor, more available nutrients to the crops, so they're able to have a lot more flexibility on their land application are some of the bigger benefits.
And this requires a bit of water, too. What happens to that water that becomes part of the system?
Sure. So one of the newer, most exciting parts of what we are trying to do is ultimately provide more tools to the farmers. And manure itself is approximately 90% water. And that has pros and cons to it. You know, the cons to it is it's expensive to move around and creates a lot of volume. So we have used several different technologies to attempt to concentrate those nutrients. And as a byproduct of concentrating those nutrients, we're creating clean water. So taking some water out of the manure, leaving more nutrients to the farm, and then having a other use for that water, whether it's using it back on the farm, irrigating crops, or potentially even putting into a river.
So, if it goes into the river, it's probably going to be cleaner than it was.
It's cleaner than the river we're putting it in. So,
yeah.
With extremely high standards for any discharge water, absolutely.
Yeah. So, you mentioned there's lots going on in Europe. Why? How did it get started there, or why has it been so popular there compared to here? I mean, it's starting to grow here, but...
Yeah, so I think you have kind of two challenges in our industry. You've had technological challenges, and then you have economic challenges. And in Europe, they've just been doing it longer. So there's more established companies, for example, that have been building biodigester facilities for decades. Technical schools have degrees literally for biogas plant electricians, for example. So it's just a more established industry. A lot of that technology has come to the United States. Some of it has been supported well and is well established. Some of it has struggled. Also, a lot of North American companies have now entered the market as it's become more established and we're getting better support locally. So in the United States, I think we're beyond the technological challenges that's kind of occurred over the last, I'll say, my career of 20 years, that's really progressed. I think where where we're at currently is more of the economic challenges. So we have plenty of feedstock, especially in Wisconsin. We're the home of the dairy industry. We have cows, we have crops, we grow a lot of food. We have a lot of what I look at as feedstock. So So we have the feedstock. So when I look at the economics of a project, that's usually our biggest hurdle. We produce renewable fuel. Renewable fuel, the value has been better recognized in the industry and has helped spur some pretty rapid growth the last 3, 4, 5 years in the biogas space. And ultimately what Europe did and what spurred their growth is their government put a higher value on the renewable energy and energy independence is what spurred their growth. And ultimately it made it so that banks and investors were they knew what their revenue stream was going to be. It was backed by the government, and that's what spurred their growth.
So let's go back to, I remember Mark or somebody was telling me how much the product that comes from this can actually heat a lot of homes.
Right. So the simple example is the Cray farm with about 1,200 cows and some animals. So they're a fairly typical, I'll say, larger farm. And they make enough electricity to power over 500-600 homes continuously.
It's amazing. Mark, Carl Crave, our guest today. Carl is Vice President of Operations for Dynamic Renewables. It's a Wisconsin-based company specializing in producing renewable gas and other products from dairy farm manure. Questions for him? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us for WPR News. Larry Mueller here. You know, listener support gives you the content you value on WPR, including this program. And as we approach WPR's one-day member drive on March 6th, you can help WPR programs right now, as a matter of fact. When 600 donors give before the drive starts, before March 6th, a group of generous members will add an extra $10,000. So you can join in with your gift of any amount at WPR.org/donate. You can do that right now at WPR.org/donate. As we talk with Carl Crave, Vice President of Operations at Dynamic Renewables, it's a Wisconsin-based company producing renewable gas and other products from dairy farm manure. Great to have him with us. And again, you can join in at 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. Let's take a call. Elaine in Ripon up first here. Hi, Elaine. Thanks for calling.
Yes, my son gets bedding, it's like a sawdust-like byproduct of this digestive system in El Dorado. And he brings it home and puts a whole trailer full of that stuff on my garden. Is that good?
Yeah, that is another great use for that co-product that we're generating. Cows love to lay on it, and that has a lot of nutrients to it as well. So one of the benefits when that manure has been through the anaerobic digester is it breaks down the organic nutrients in that, so they're much more plant available. So when you put it on your garden, you're able to really recognize the value of those nutrients. So it is very porous, so it's good for your soil health, and you rototill that in, it's good for water retention, and it's a great soil amendment, especially if you're in the central part of the state where there's a lot of sandy soil. So that's another great product. Right now there's a pretty good value for utilizing that for bedding. But in the past we've worked with several horticultural companies as well for that use exactly. So glad it's working well for you.
Yeah. Thanks, Elaine. Appreciate the call. You got lucky there, Elaine. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And again, you could join us 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Ethan emailed, part of his master's thesis focused on using small diameter timber that was traditionally used as wood pulp for biomass gasification processes, similar to what the guest, what you're talking about today. Do you know if there's any efforts to introduce a biomass gasification into our electric grid, whether it's from manure or other sources? There's a biomass gasification dual fire power plant in Finland that has introduced this technology.
Yeah, the gasification is really an interesting technology that I'd say is kind of on the fringe of kind of what I do. And I've always been interested in it. It's a great additional step that you could utilize to harvest the energy that's in those nutrients or in that manure. And so gasification ultimately can create biogas as well. You know, it's all about carbon. Manure is carbon, and that's what we're harvesting here. And it also provides an excellent soil amendment in the biochar. So biochar goes back thousands and thousands of years as a soil amendment product. And, very interested to kind of see how that technology develops. I think there's been a few USDA pilot projects on poultry manure and some dairy manure solids that have been done here in the U.S., but definitely in a kind of an interesting new technology that hopefully continue to put some money into figuring it out.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned poultry manure. And obviously, these kinds of operations could work for swine or poultry or other operations, other livestock.
Yeah, any livestock or actually organic waste, food waste also. If it's organic in nature, it can be digested and create biogas. So whether it's grass clippings or poultry manure, hog manure, we've built projects on all those types of products. So as long as it's organic in nature, it will eventually make gas.
How many, let's talk about Dynamic Renewables for a minute. How many biodigester projects has Dynamic Renewables helped develop?
Well, we've developed over our lifetime a couple of dozen projects that we've been involved with, developed, at some point operated. Currently, we've got six that we're operating around the Midwest, and our biggest one being BC Organics up in Greenleaf, Wisconsin. That's the project which we actually combined manure from about 13 farms to one centralized site. So that's a very unique project.
Yeah, it is indeed. And Greenleaf, that's what, about 20 miles, I'm thinking, south of Green Bay, somewhere?
Yep, just south, kind of between Green Bay and Appleton there, just south of De Pere.
Yeah. Well, if you've got 13 farms, there's a lot of gallons of manure that's coming into that.
There are. So when on our projects, economies of scale are very important. It's just a rather expensive technology. And the more cows and the more waste, the more cost-effective it is. So that was a unique opportunity where there's a lot of cows and farms in a small geographic area, and we're able to locate near them as well as near a natural gas pipeline, which is also important to us as we're trying to get that end fuel to the pipeline. And that was a good location. And it is a lot of 13 farms, and some of those are They're all family-owned farms, multi-generational, all very well-run farms, and they range from 500, 600, 700 cow, what would be considered a small farm, all the way up to 7,000, which would be considered a very large farm, and everything in between.
Yeah. I was thinking, the methane, that's one of the issues with that has been raised by environmentalists or conservationists and so forth. Capturing methane, and I would expect that a fair amount of methane gets captured in this whole process. Manure itself would have methane.
Exactly, and that's the goal, is to capture as much of that methane as possible. So normally on a dairy farm, I mentioned that odor that you might smell in the summer. So in a farmer's manure lagoon, as they're storing that manure for land application, especially during the summer, that manure would heat up and it would create the biogas. And biogas, part of that is the kind of rotten egg smell that you mm-hmm. would smell as you're driving by a farm. And that part of that is the biogas. So what normally is happening in a lagoon, we're doing that in the anaerobic digester. So we're putting it in that controlled environment and maximizing the amount of biogas we're producing. So our goal is to produce the biogas and capture every bit of it, because that's our main salable product is the gas.
Yeah, let's talk some more about that. You have a client, one of your main clients for biogas is in California, or has been at least.
Correct. So the one of the things that has spurred the economics of these types of projects is the value for the renewable natural gas, what we call RNG. And RNG, renewable natural gas, is used primarily as a source of vehicle fuel. So a lot of large companies, you know, everything that's made in the United States gets shipped before it gets mm-hmm. to you or I to yep. consume. It gets put on a truck and sometimes moved multiple times. So when companies are looking at their overall carbon footprint, the transportation is a huge part of it. So our fuel that we're producing, that natural gas, is often used in natural gas vehicles that are moving products around. Or in the case of the state of California, they have mandates where other vehicles, such as city buses, utilize that renewable natural gas as well. So a lot of our end customers are actually in the state of California that have the value for that fuel.
Kent in Reedstown emailed to ask, does it pay to haul manure, say, from Iowa to a digester?
At our BC Organics project, we pipe manure from two farms, and then we haul from 11 others. And most of them are within 15 or 20 minutes of the facility. Some of them are literally right down the road, so they're very close. So the economics of hauling are often pretty tough. You need to be relatively close, and that takes some infrastructure on the farms as well for collecting and getting that manure onto a truck daily. So we haul manure 365 days a year into our facility. When it's snowing and freezing outside, we're still transporting. So it generally that's kind of about the limit is for us is within a half an hour or less.
And I was thinking about the Greenleaf near Green Bay, that project there, where it's sited. So I'm not mistaken, it was sited, so it gets pretty close to a gas line, is it not?
It is. It's right near a large transmission line. So one of the challenges of rural United States is we don't have the best natural gas infrastructure, if any. You know, a lot of us are still on LP or don't have any natural gas at all. So fortunate there to be able to be near a large pipeline, because we are producing a relatively large volume of RNG, renewable natural gas, at that facility. So it does require a larger pipe than just a little distribution pipe even.
Yeah. Mike in Colgate, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Mike.
Hi, guys. This is Mike. I've had a question for a long time. It has to do with my septic system. So I'm in a little bit rural area, and I know there's a lot of, I don't know what the percentage of people that are not on a rural septic system. And I've often wondered, actually, maybe I have two questions for you. One is, is there any interest in doing what you're doing? And I've often thought about using my hot water heater as kind of a battery, that I could run that methane off and kind of use it, you know, and be self-contained on my property. But then listening to you guys this morning, my septic caller comes once a year, and he has to take that septic to an approved place, and I assume it's typically a farm that they put out on a field. Is there a chance that since he's got it anyways, he could go to, you know, redirect to a system like yours?
Yeah, that's an interesting opportunity, and what you're kind of asking about is actually fairly common in India, China, more I'll say third world countries that don't have energy available. So they make very small scale home type digesters where where a single family could put their some of their human waste into. Some of if they might have a pig or two, they'd put their pig waste into. Any of their food scraps would go into an enclosed little vessel, like a 55-gallon drum type scale, and they would use that. They would harvest that gas and often use it for cooking in their kitchen, actually, on like a single burner stove. So in developing countries, that's very common. In Wisconsin, unfortunately, what we have is winter. So where they have warm ambient conditions to keep that waste warm and generating gas. In our case, it would probably only work a couple months out of the year. But you are right, human waste can make energy, and larger cities like Madison, Milwaukee, Wausau, they do have anaerobic digesters that will process that waste. Appleton has a mm-hmm. has a big system. So there's I don't know, maybe 10 around Wisconsin big municipalities that do, and your local septic hauler may haul to one of those already.
Yeah, there you go, Mike. Thank you for calling. Vern in Eau Claire County, your turn. Hi, Vern.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for letting me on. So one thing we got to get rid of are the nitrates in the water. None of these systems do that. So what you do, if you mix cellulose or called sawdust with the poop from cities, farms, and you combine it, and then you let it dry, put a little coal with it so you raise the temperature when it's burnt, and you dry it, you make bricks out of it, you can burn in a conventional power station because they use methane gas, you know, on these dumps like Eau Claire County landfill. But it doesn't give it the nitrates, and that's one of the big problems. But it's,
yeah.
Yeah, for the most part, nutrients that go into a digester come out of the digester. You're right there. And ultimately, it's up to that dairy farmer who gets those nutrients back. They land apply for that nutrient value, right? They're still harvesting their crops to feed their cows, and they need those nutrients to grow their crops. So whether it's the nutrients that came from their manure that they're utilizing, or it's commercial fertilizer, the farms still need those nutrients. So one of the things with a digester is it does give them more flexibility to kind of be creative on when they're applying their manure and try to get those nutrients onto the crops at more desired times, more so than just, you know, the big applications that typically happen in the spring and in the fall before or after harvest. So a lot of farms are taking advantages of the more available nutrients and doing applications throughout the growing season, which has been very beneficial to their production.
Yeah. Thanks, Vern. Appreciate the call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm wondering about, we talked about California. Are there other buyers of renewable gas?
There are. So it really kind of starts with some of the larger companies out there. So some of those Fortune 500 companies that are trying to reduce their carbon footprint have gotten into the transportation side of it, like we talked about earlier. They tend to be the more innovative leaders, and there is a cost to doing that. So,
sure.
So those companies that kind of have the more corporate objectives have been the leaders there for buying more renewable natural gas. And it can be used not only in vehicles, but it could be used in a natural gas power plant to create electricity, for example, or could be used to put into a pipeline that the same pipe that goes to our homes if we wanted to use it in our own homes. So there are expanding markets. I think what California has done through some of the regulations is at least provided some framework and guidance to the value of the renewable, the carbon intensity, what they call, of our gas. And that's kind of been a benefit of their oversight.
Yeah. A lot of things start in California and work their way
right.
Way east.
May not be perfect, but at least it's a start.
At least,
you know, and out west, Oregon, Washington have similar programs. New York, Minnesota have proposed similar programs. So it's at some point there's been talk in the past of having a similar federal program. So we'll see.
Well, I asked about that because I was thinking about viability. You know, how viable is your business without California, or, you know, if you didn't have them.
Yeah, and that voluntary market is important, and it is growing. So it's been that's a lot of what our efforts are spent on, are understanding those buyers, and some of those are actually international buyers even, that are looking at different ways to fuel their businesses or fuel their transportation. So yeah, it's a certainly an evolving market.
The process also produces, as we've kind of talked about here, concentrated nutrients that are returned to the farms. Is this a better fertilizer for their farms than raw minerals or raw manure or even other commercial fertilizer?
Well, it's substantially better than commercial fertilizer in the fact it contains all the micronutrients and the other organic material and the all the other things that soil needs to grow. That's why manure has been used for fertilizer since the beginning of man. The downside, as I mentioned, of that product is it contains a lot of water, and water is expensive to move around. So some of the technologies that we've utilized are focused on reducing that volume and separating out those nutrients. And that's really an evolving industry in itself. There's a handful of companies that have been doing it now for 5 or 10 years, and they continue to get better at it all the time. But it is from the farmer's perspective, that is more of their priority or goal of some of our systems is to utilize that nutrient concentration. So when you put those nutrients on a truck, every time you put wheels under something, it gets expensive, right? So by concentrating those nutrients, you're helping take some trucks off the road, and ultimately giving the farm a little more tools in their toolbox in terms of how much they can apply and at what different times throughout the year they can apply. They're able to apply on growing crops without burning them with the nutrients or with the ammonia. So those are all benefits to a farm that give them more flexibility and hopefully higher yields along with it.
So how does the relationship work with farms, with the farmer? So does the farmer pay your company to produce it and then gets this back in return, or is...
Yeah, so we are a developer and operator of these systems. So we often bring the equity to build the facility on a farm or in the case of BC Organics, between the farms. And these facilities that we're talking about, these are very modern technology. They're built similar to like how a waste treatment facility would be built in your municipality. So these are investments are tens of millions of dollars on these farms. So they're built to last 20 years. They're operated by our operators who are trained specifically on the technology, how to operate it, how to do it safely. So when we make those investments, our saleable product is the renewable natural gas. And at the end of the day, there's usually some sort of profit share benefit that goes back to the farm. So we get their manure, we process it to capture the gas, they'll get those nutrients back. And then sometimes it's a financial profit share at the end of the day, or every system's a little different. But at the end of the day, there is a little piece in it for the farm, and hopefully they're getting some of those other benefits like we talked about with odor reduction and better nutrient handling and things like that.
Paul in Cross Plains has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Paul.
Hi, how are you today, Larry?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Appreciate you answering my call. Previously, not too long ago, there was a program, and it might well have been one of your programs, I think, that talked about this sort of issue. And one of the things they brought up was that in processing manure like this, whether it's animal or human or a combination of, there was a significant concentration of heavy metals, so that they found heavy metal contamination in the field that had received the solids from the waste processing. And I'm wondering whether you have figured that into the calculation.
Paul, thanks for calling. Well, Carl, what about it?
Sure, Paul. So some metals, there's, I mentioned those micronutrients in the what we call digestate, what comes out of the digester, and ultimately comes land applied. There's some metals and micronutrients in that, and some metals are beneficial to the soil to a certain extent, and like anything, too much of anything is bad, right? And ultimately, what goes into a digester comes out of the digester. So those nutrients, those metals, what goes in comes out. So it wouldn't necessarily concentrate it or change it. And when a farmer applies their manure and those nutrients to their land, they have what's called a nutrient management plan. So they send their exact product that they're putting on the land to a lab for analysis. And they would look at nutrients and micronutrients and metals as well. And ultimately, their agronomist looks at those results compared to what they're going to be growing on a field, what crops they're going to be growing over the next three seasons, how much their anticipated harvest would be. And their agronomist would recommend the rate for that application. So that's all taken into account, whether it's the nutrients or metals. That's all looked at by the farm's agronomist.
Paul, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. So there's not a way to take those heavy metals if you wanted to take a heavy metal out of that process.
I would assume there is a way. With enough chemistry, you can usually take out just about anything. But not something usually when you're applying on thousands and thousands of acres that's enough concentration to be a concern. That tends to be more of a concern on human waste, where we have a lot more stuff that goes down our toilets.
Yeah, absolutely. Carl Crave, our guest today, Vice President of Operations for Dynamic Renewables. You can join in, too. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're taking a look at biodigesters with our guest Carl Crave, is a Vice President of Operations for Dynamic Renewables. It's a Wisconsin-based company, specializes in producing renewable gas and other products as well from dairy farm manure. Questions, give a call at 800-642-1234. You could email us to talk@WPR.org. Let's take a call from Judy in Madison. Judy, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hello, Larry. I'm calling because I think we have too many cows in Wisconsin, and they are ruining our state. Wherever you go, it smells. And I also go to the beach up in Door County, and I happen to go, it's been maybe a year and a half, down to the beach near Bailey's Harbor, and I recognize that smell right away of manure, and the water was brown. I called the DNR, and they checked on the sewage systems in Bailey's Harbor and also with an agent there who went down to the Bailey's Harbor beach. And they all said, no, there was no problem there. But I don't think the water from Lake Michigan had gotten around that far. And I know in Kewaunee they have a lot of big farms. Who needs thousands and thousands of cows?
Well, Carl, what do you got to say?
Well, I think an anaerobic digester has actually been a really great tool for farmers who are wanting to be a better neighbor and reduce some of that odor ultimately that comes off when they're land applying or from their lagoons. So I know I've worked with several farms that have built a digester, even though economically it was not wise, simply to reduce odor. It was their number one driver. And all of our farmers, they live in the same area and community that their farms are, so they want to be good neighbors. So a digester is a good tool for that, as well as giving them other opportunities for land application of those nutrients. So we look at it as a tool and a benefit to the farms, and that's one of the reasons that they come to us is for some of those technological solutions to their problem.
Judy, thanks for calling. I was thinking about Dan Egan's book, The Devil's Element. I interviewed him probably a year or two ago, and he talked about phosphorus in the water and in the systems and stuff, and mentioned, and he actually mentioned that Brown County area, because that's a big, heavy...
It is one of the most concentrated areas of dairy cows in the United States, and that's one of the reasons we were there. So it's one of the exciting parts to me is there's a lot of technologies and equipment that's becoming more feasible every day. And right now it does require economies of scale to make that equipment viable. And I use that project as an example. There is 0% chance that our technology would normally be built on a 500 cow dairy farm like we work with up there. But by combining those farms so that I have 30,000 cows, now I can try some of those new technologies, and I can get those nutrients where they're needed. Because ultimately, the nutrients are going to be put on those fields. There is still a net demand for nutrients, even with that large concentration for cows. It's really about getting those nutrients where they're needed, cost effectively.
And is there any opportunities in that area for even an additional digester?
There are. Yes, there's still other little pods of farms up in that part of the country where we're looking to do some additional systems. Most farms that have digesters on them typically have 3 or 4,000 cows or more. A lot of those have had digesters put on them over the last few years. So now it's a matter of putting two or three farms together. And up in that area, that is kind of the hot area. So we look at that as a great opportunity.
I know you've looked at Iowa operations, and Iowa's come up a little bit in it. And you have involvement. Dynamic Renewables has some involvement, at least in the Marshall Ridge Renewable Energy Center. How big is that facility?
That is a 3-digester facility. So for in terms of a single farm, it's a fairly large one.
And so how many cows and so forth is it serving?
About 7,000 cows.
Okay. Now, in Iowa, they passed a law allowing animal feeding operations with digesters to expand or exceed the normal limits on the number of animals. How does that affect the digester business in Iowa?
Yeah, so I think Iowa DNR, and we work very closely with the DNR or their regulator, similar regulator in every state. And I think the DNRs have recognized the value of this type of technology. They understand that it's beneficial to the farms, it's beneficial to the neighbors, and I think that's sort of their way of sort of using the carrot versus the stick approach. Mm-hmm. is farms are being proactive, you know, they're trying to do better with their waste, and this technology is evolving. So part of it is to spur that further development and keep learning, keep growing the industry. So Iowa specifically has looked at it as a benefit and recognized some of those benefits I've talked about. So that's what allows a farm to grow, because they are doing what's right environmentally.
Richard in New London will go to you now. Hi, Richard.
Hi. I have a couple questions. One, is there anything you have to do with the methane gas to make it natural gas, or is it that just purified?
No, it's a great question. So biogas is about 60% methane, and methane is the valuable combustible fuel. And along with that is hydrogen sulfide, so that's kind of that rotten egg smell that you would normally smell, and then CO2, carbon dioxide. So and usually some water vapor. So we will process that biogas and basically remove those contaminants, so the hydrogen sulfide, the CO2 in the water, and then we're left with the methane.
Okay, the other question would be is, you know, you said Madison and stuff using the sewer plants to make methane gas, and I'm not sure what they're using the gas for, but wouldn't it be profitable for the small sewer plants, towns, have their own methane gas to run a generator, being that California says this natural gas is cleaner than the other, that's why you're shipping it there?
Yes, using the biogas to create a renewable electricity is a great use for it. I think the challenge with that is electric utilities in Wisconsin included actually do not value that renewable electricity. So about 10, 15 years in Wisconsin, we had a renewable electrical portfolio that utilities were required to meet a certain percentage of their overall electricity needs with renewable. And at that time, most of the facilities that we built and operated created electricity. And that was a great use for it. And since those minimum standards have been fulfilled, all of them have not increased their demand for renewable electricity. So the value of the electricity has not been realized. So value as transportation fuel has become the norm today. Mm.
Kevin, email. Thank you, Richard, for calling. Appreciate it. Did we answer all your questions?
I think so. I mean, I would think that would take the place of our solar panels, would help with that, so we wouldn't have to cover up our fields with solar panels. That could be crops.
I would agree. Renewable electricity is an excellent source of energy. I 100% agree. And usually, along with renewable electricity, there is some heat that comes off of those engines that can be captured to heat a facility or heat a waste treatment plant or heat a digester. So I agree. It's an excellent value or potential value for that energy, and especially on a smaller scale where a small flow of renewable natural gas usually isn't cost effective for all that infrastructure that's required. Producing electricity is a great alternative, but it goes back to some of my initial comments about it. We're fighting the economics. If no one values that renewable electricity, I can make it, but if I can't make money at it, I won't build very many of them.
Yeah. Kevin emailed that the lady who called earlier should know that the smell at Bailey's Harbor was decomposing cladophora algae filled with quagga mussel excrement. So it wasn't cow manure in that particular case. A caller who couldn't stay with us raised concern that there isn't enforcement of nutrient management plans and controls. Farmers are self-reporting what they apply.
Yeah, I think the system relies on self-reporting and then ultimately review and monitoring of that. The farms we work with very highly value those nutrients and getting them where they're needed. They don't have enough nutrients. So the farms we work with are definitely some of the, I'll say, more technologically advanced. They're have been on top of maximizing everything they do, whether it's nutrient application or producing milk. They're on top of it. So for the most part, they're not real motivated to over-apply. So not saying it doesn't happen at times across the state, but in general, they're wanting to get the nutrients where they're needed, so they're not supplementing them with commercial fertilizer at a cost out of their pocket.
Yeah. So what's next for your business?
Next for our business, we've grown pretty rapidly over the last several years. I think what's exciting for me is we're not limited by capital. We have capital to build and own projects, and I've been excited with our team. We've grown in a lot of, we've grown to a scale now where we have a lot of expertise. You know, I have full-time health and safety people on staff. I have full-time people to handle accounting and all those things that, in the past as a relatively small business, maybe slowed us down. But I think we're at a stage now where we have in-house expertise, a lot of operators with multiple years of expertise, and really trying to utilize our decades of knowledge in the renewable gas space to grow more projects. You know, maybe look at some of the organic food waste type opportunities where we can harvest some of the energy from the all the wasted food that we mm-hmm. have in our country, which would otherwise go to a waste treatment plant or landfill. That's exciting to me. And not only just continuing to grow the business and work with good people.
Well, Carl, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Sorry we didn't get to everybody today, but appreciate your being with us in here in the studio. It's good to meet you, and thank you so much.
Appreciate it, Larry.
Carl Crave, Vice President of Operations for Dynamic Renewables, a Wisconsin-based company. Coming up, we're going to talk about a new book about a Wisconsin DNR firefighter. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you with us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Well, we're turning our attention to a book that's just been out. It came out in 2024 in October. And it's written by a Wisconsin guy, and it's written about Wisconsin in a lot of ways. It's titled When the Smoke Clears, story, and the subtitle, Stories and Reflections of a Wisconsin Forest Ranger. I finished reading it last weekend, and I really enjoyed it. And I'm pretty sure you will enjoy it, too, and enjoy hearing what Blair Anderson has to say about it. He's the author of the book. Blair spent many of his 30 years as a state forest ranger in the Spring Green area. And his book is really a reflections on his 30 years of work as a forest ranger, and again, a lot of it in the Spring Green area. And I hope you'll join in as we move along today. I learned quite a bit about the fire situation in Wisconsin. I learned about, I learned some great stories. He's got some great stories in the book about his own experiences and some things that I think you're going to find interesting, too. You can join that conversation. Maybe you have a question about our Wisconsin fires. How are they different from those out in California, for example? He can tell you that. Or maybe you've got questions about fires that have occurred here. Give a call. The number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. And Blair Anderson, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Larry. I appreciate the opportunity to be here with you and talk about this a little bit.
Oh, man, it was really fun for me to read. You had a decades-long career as a forest ranger with the DNR. It was funny, interesting to me that you started. Your working life started in the corporate world.
It did. I grew up in Chicago and ended up working for a Fortune 500 company for about 4 years. And being a child of the 60s, I was idealistic, just like everybody else, and decided I wanted to mix business with resources. So I came to Madison and got a forestry degree here. And then 1980, the job market was not so good, so I took a test and got an interview for the state forestry job, and they offered me a job, and I thought, well, it's something to do until a real job comes along. 31 years later, I'm ready to write a book.
Yeah, so yeah. You suggest in your book that many people have kind of romantic or unrealistic ideas about what a forest ranger does.
I think that's true. Yeah, yeah. I think sometimes people get this image of a tower, you know, out in the middle of no place, on top of a mountain, 40 miles from the nearest civilization, and a lone person that goes out and saves the world for Smokey, and has little else going on, just a life totally committed to nothing else but the resource out there, and that's that's a good romantic notion, but it's not very realistic.
I remember, I think when my first year on the job, I had to go to northern Wisconsin to cover another thing, and I saw one of the fire towers.
Yes.
I thought, you know what, I'm going to climb up that tower and interview the guy that's in that tower. And I took about 5 steps up that tower, and I realized, no.
Yeah.
I climbed right back down. Yep. I didn't go all the way up there.
Yeah.
Well, you didn't spend any time in it, well, maybe not much time of any time in a tower.
No, never did. The towers were in most of the areas that we protected for longer starting in the 20s. In the southern part of the state, we started protection later, and we didn't use towers. I had some old DNR friends that said, "Oh, you need to put some of the tower stories in your book." and I understand there are quite a few very good ones, but they were not ones I was involved in, and I wanted to stick to stuff that I knew.
Well, and you wrote that forestry was perhaps the best respected element of the DNR, because forester, you know, they're most helpful and minimally involved in regulations.
Yeah. Usually when we get, you know, when we get involved in fire, sometimes there's some legal entanglements, but the forestry side of it, which was also a very big part of my job in Spring Green, involves helping people, you know, write plans for their forests. It's a very long-term thing, probably the longest-term activity that people plan in their lives, because you're looking out, you know, 100 years or so in a forest, and we help them with that. We helped them with tree planting. We had some cost-sharing programs that we could offer to help them do the stuff that they wanted and needed to do anyway. So we kind of came alongside and were helpful that way, and I think we were appreciated a little bit because of that.
Yeah. Well, I can't tell you how many times, many, many times over the years, I told people from one area of the state or another, when they had a question relating to this, you ought to see your DNR, give us your DNR forester a call.
Yeah.
They'll come out.
Yep. Yes, they will. They'll come out and they'll see what's going on. And there was a good connection between not just our forestry people, but like if you had a property and you had a stream going through it, we could get a fisheries person involved. Most of the county forestry people were connected with, you know, federal resources like, you know, the SCS and so forth. So they were able to bring other, you know, whatever other resources were needed to bear on a given situation. So it was really a pretty helpful thing, and not regulatory for the most part.
You know, one of the things that surprised me a lot was the number of fires. We're talking about your area, that Spring Green area, that the number of fires at certain times of the year. I mean, you mentioned once that you, mentioned it in passing, that you'd already was 12 or 14 fires for that day.
Yep. Yeah.
And you were on to another one.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, 12 to 14, I never read about this.
Yeah. Well, a lot of them are pretty small.
Yeah.
Our Easter weekend was always that was usually in early April, and down here in this part of the, in the southern part of the state, that was when we were really starting to seriously dry out if we weren't getting rains. That was the time, and so we, you know, when that time of year came, I'd just say goodbye at home and say, I'll see you when I see you, because, you know, as long as the sun was shining, we were working.
Yeah. So the when I say working, you were working. I mean, you had your own equipment and could do it.
Yes.
But you worked in tangent with many other local fire departments, for example.
Yes. Yeah, very much so. The areas down in the south were geographically larger than they were and than they are in some of the hotter areas in the, like the pine areas in the state and the central sands and northwest. So I actually had, I think, 20 or 22 different fire departments that I worked with, you know, depending on where a fire might be. So it was a lot of good opportunity to connect with those folks, and a lot of differences in fire departments.
I see, yeah. You say they come in a lot of sizes.
Yes, yeah, yeah, yeah. And some of them are better funded than others, and some of them are in, you know, smaller towns where, you know, a lot of the jobs have left town, and so there aren't a lot of people around during the daytime, and it's kind of a challenge for them. But, you know, one of the really nice things about my job, I thought, was the fire community. I mean, everybody that you work with, you know, other rangers, occasionally up in the north, we'd work with federal fire folks, but certainly the fire departments, they were so committed and enthusiastic about doing fire management work, whether, like for the fire departments, whether it was structural, which they were better trained in, or wildland, which we were better trained in. And there was just a lot of mutual work and a lot of mutual respect that was involved in that. And that just made it apart from all the hard work of fighting fires, it was just a very pleasant work environment to be involved in.
I was at a meeting once in Cottage Grove, Wisconsin, and in the middle of the meeting, there were a lot of people there. Suddenly, there was a tone went off, and about 10 guys jumped up and ran for the door.
Yeah.
And they just literally jumped up and ran.
Yes.
And that was a volunteer, Cottage Grove Volunteer Fire Department.
Yep. Yeah.
And these guys are volunteers.
Yes, they're volunteers. When I came to Spring Green, keep in mind I grew up in Chicago. When I came to Spring Green, it was my first introduction to this whole concept of a volunteer fire department. And I was just flabbergasted at the amount of time and energy and commitment that people in the community were willing to commit to be prepared for fire situations, for the EMS people to be prepared for trained and ready for those kinds of situations, and all on a volunteer basis, just as kind of a reflection of how neighbors take care of neighbors in a bigger sense. And it was so different from anything I'd seen before, and it was really attractive to me, and I very much enjoyed kind of getting involved in the community.
Yeah, and you write a really nice, you have so many great stories, but I thought you wrote a very insightful discussion about community and what a community like that, how it operates.
Yes, yeah. It's fascinating, and it intrigued me, and I really took note of a lot of different things about it, and I tried to include some of those in the book. I've got a friend that grew up on a farm and went to the ag school here, and it's only in the last few years it occurred to me to ask him what he majored in. He's running a mission effort in Guatemala now, but I asked him, what did you major in when you went to ag school? And he said, rural sociology.
Yeah.
And I'd never thought of that as a discipline. But, boy, having spent the time I spent in Spring Green, I can sure see it. I sure understand it. It's different.
Well, I had a lot of courses in rural sociology as an undergraduate.
Well, good. Yeah. It's fascinating.
That's what really fascinated me about it. Jeff in Berry Mills has something. Let's go there. Hi, Jeff.
Yeah, I couldn't resist this call. Last week was Patterson Park, and now this week it's the fire tower. When I was on that work detail for the youth conservation camp back in about 1968, a ranger came into camp this morning looking for a volunteer, found out I volunteered for what he was doing. I got to go paint a ranger tower that day, leaning out the windows with a brush on extension, painting it silver while he was on the roof painting it gold.
Oh, my.
Oh, man.
That's. I'm glad you were able to do that because I couldn't. By the time I got to the 10th step on the ladder going up the tower, I would have been freaking out from the height. So thank you very much for what you did.
Jeff, thanks a lot for calling. Oh, man. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you can email us to talk@wpr.org. Talking with Blair Anderson. He authored the book, When the Smoke Clears, Stories and Reflections of a Wisconsin Forest Ranger. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, talking today with Blair Anderson. He's written a dandy book. It's titled, When the Smoke Clears, Stories and Reflections of a Wisconsin forest ranger, and you'll learn a lot about forest rangers and about fires here in the state, and a lot about what goes into being a forest ranger. And Blair certainly has lots of experiences to share in his book. So join in, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Matthew emailed to ask, what was the most common cause of fires you responded to? Like debris burning, railroads? Yeah.
Well, that's an easy one. Almost all the fires that we have in Wisconsin are caused one way or another by people, which is not necessarily the same as it is elsewhere. But most often it was a result of people deliberately burning something. The burning barrel or a brush pile or a bunch of seed bags or whatever, and it gets away. That was probably the cause of, debris burning was the cause of at least half of the fires that we had.
And you talk about structure, and you've already mentioned this, structure fires, wildland fires. These, and they're fought in the different ways, are they not?
Yeah, they're very different. And most simplistically, with a structure fire, you have a high fuel load in a fixed place, and you kind of come to it and set up around it and put it out. With a wildland fire, you have much lighter fuels. And they're scattered, and so the fire is moving. And so there's a unlike a structural fire, there's a premium placed on being mobile. And so we have vehicles like our small fire vehicles or 4x4s. They can get around in rougher country than a big tanker or a pumper from a fire department, and we have crawler tractors that we use to put in plow lines around fires that can work through woods.
Yeah, and when if you got a wildland fire, you don't necessarily have you can't drive right up to it.
No. And sometimes you don't want to. If they're that hot, there are safety concerns that are you have to keep in mind constantly, and they're always changing because the fire's changing, the fire's moving. Maybe it's getting into some new fuels, and there are other considerations. Maybe there's a house ahead of it, and you have to make a specific plan related to protecting the house or trying to steer the fire around the house so that you don't have problem with that kind of exposure. Yeah. All kinds of things going on. It's very stimulating.
I was thinking about myself. I had an experience when I was a young guy. I was helping one of the local farmers, and he was burning some marsh.
Yep.
And he started a backfire, and so he had there were the two fires, and I was going to run across between the two because my buddy was over on the other side, and I started, and then I don't know. It was going kind of slow, but then suddenly it just took off, and I'd have been halfway across.
Yep. You were wise to restrain yourself.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Yeah, things can change very quickly. Winds can come up. Winds can shift. There was always a time of day, late morning, early afternoon, when you could just see, like if we were doing a prescribed burn, it would be creeping along, and you could just sense how the relative humidity was dropping, and the way the fire burned just took on a whole different nature. It just got more ferocious, and you realized, we got to get this thing wrapped up here because the weather's changing, and the afternoon breezes are starting to kick in, and we don't want this to get too exciting.
Yeah, you told one. Well, I don't know. It wasn't humorous. It was in a way, but it wasn't. You were with a TV reporter had wanted to come out.
Yes. Yeah. They're always more humorous in retrospect than they are at the time. Yeah, this was a gal that was with one of the TV stations in town here, and we were doing a prescribed burn, and she was really quite interested in it, and things just got going a little bit faster, and I was trying to walk her out to a place where we would be safe, where we would be out of the range of the fire, and I couldn't get her to move, and we had
she had heels on. She was kind of dressed up.
Oh, but she was dressed to the nines. Yeah, she looked great, but not the kind of thing that you necessarily want to wear out to a burn.
Yeah,
and so yeah, that was. I won't go any further. You got to read about it. It was interesting,
needless to say, she wound up in some water, and
yes, she did. And the report that she filed included only video of the fire. It did not include her. She was a mess by the end of the fire.
Oh, man. Mike in Oregon, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hey, fellas. Hey, Larry. Yeah, I've got a firefighter story for you. We were up north at our cottage, and the whole backside is national forest. And I had a little antique boat I was putting into the shoreline, and there some of your guys were there with their SUVs and whatever with the lights blaring. And they said, hey, could you give us a hand? And I said, sure, what do you need? He says, well, could you use your boat to go to the other side of the lake where it's national forest and pick up one of our guys? I said, sure, you know. So I went over there, and this poor guy was on foot with all of his fire gear on, you know, that thick jacket and the pants and everything. It was about 90 degrees out.
Oh.
And when he came on his way back, he ended up in the middle of the lake and needed a way back instead of going around the whole thing. And he must have brought 10,000 mosquitoes with him. He could barely breathe with all the mosquitoes everywhere. And I just felt so sorry for that guy running on foot to try and get to this fire because there's no way for the ATVs to get there.
Yep, yep. Yeah, access can be an issue. And in some of the northern areas we have in Wisconsin and the UP, that can get you into low areas that are just, like you say, you can hardly help but breathe the mosquitoes. When you've been through some of that, by the time you get to the fire and it's a little hotter and drier and the mosquitoes are driven away, it's almost a relief.
Mike, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. It reminded me of another story in your book. And this one has some real practical applicability to anybody listening right now. And that was, I might have been early in your career. There was a fire, I think it was a marsh, or at least a marsh-like area. It was burning, but the way the wind was, the smoke was only kind of like up to your knees.
Yes, yes, that was fairly, I know what you're talking about. That was a very late spring fire. In fact, we had kind of thought that we were done with fire season. Our fire season generally, it kind of begins to kick off when the snow melts, and it mostly comes to an end when things start to green up. And so things had, with this particular fire, things had greened up, and we were kind of starting to stand down a little bit. We were having very few fires, and it's funny how it just almost turns off. It's like a switch is thrown at the end of spring. But we got called out to a fire northeast of Spring Green, and I went out. I was at work, and I ended up kind of going out right in tandem with the Spring Green Fire Department. And we got out there, and it was a little fire walking up a hillside adjacent to an ag field. We couldn't even see flames. There were like 3 feet of vegetation there, and it wasn't, it was most of the fire energy was being expended evaporating the moisture in the plants. So we got in there and quite easily put the fire out. And as the story tells, a few days later I noticed my leg itched a little bit, and as the day went on and the next day came, it turned into a rash. And what I realized was that this fire had been burning through poison ivy, and that the oil, the urushiol in the poison ivy had vaporized and had gotten on my legs. And I, as much as my legs itched, I was thankful that the smoke hadn't risen enough that I had breathed it and gotten it into my lungs. But my legs were pretty miserable for quite a few days after that.
Yeah, and that reminded me. I mean, you know, there are people out there who have some poison ivy on some property and they may want to burn it. Don't be breathing that smoke in.
No, and that's not a real effective way to deal with poison ivy. And you know, if something gets away, then somebody's got to go out there and get in that smoke, and you know, with all the stuff that's in it.
Yeah.
So,
you investigated the cause of a lot of fires.
Yes.
What did you look for? I thought that was a whole interesting part to look at that you did, to look at determine the cause of the fire.
Yeah. Well, the first thing you have to do is figure out where the fire started. Frequently, I would say most of the time, that's fairly obvious. You know, if you have a V-shaped fire with a burning barrel at the base of the V, you know, I could, even in my first year, I could figure that out. but sometimes it's not so clear. And so you have to figure out where the fire started. And there are a number of different burning indicators, how the fire burns, how soot deposits on trees or on rocks, or how grass burns or lays over. There are all kinds of different ways that you can read a scene and determine what direction the fire was burning at a particular point. And when you get to a point where it's pretty unclear what direction it was burning, you're probably real close to the origin. And once you've sort of identified the origin, then you start looking around for something that might have caused it. I mean, you know, maybe there's a brush pile there. Or one time I found the residue of some fireworks. And so that, you know, so then you go to the next step of the investigation and ask around, hey, was anybody shooting off fireworks? Oh, yeah, the neighbor down the road was out here. And you kind of put two and two together and figure it out.
And what happens? I mean, you have many stories. Sometimes that can involve fines, or sometimes you kind of use your judgment.
Yes, yeah. One of the things an old sage law enforcement officer told me early on was the objective of law enforcement is compliance. You know, we're not trying to punish people. We're trying to get people to do the right thing, and so. You know, if we had a situation where somebody burned something that they shouldn't have, or burned it at the wrong time, or did something foolish, if I became convinced that they really didn't know what they were doing, then usually I just tried to give them a little 15-cent education and a warning, and called it good at that. Sometimes I'd run into the same people repeatedly, and it was apparent they knew what was right and wrong. They just needed more motivation to do the right thing, and I was happy to provide that.
Yeah, there's a few interesting stories in your book about a guy you gave a warning to, and then like a week later.
Yes. Yes, it was 2 days later.
2 days.
2 days. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I couldn't believe it.
He said he'd never do it again.
Well, I hope not.
Well, he said he'd never do it again, and then 2 days later, he did it again.
Well, the second time, I gave him more motivation to not do it again than I did the first time.
You know, another thing that I think people should think about with their own property or with their own work, and you write about this is. When you guys fight a fire and finish the fire, all right, the fire's out, but there's a mop-up.
Yes, yeah.
And that's something I think everybody needs to think about.
Yes, yeah, mop-up is mop-up is the unglamorous part of forest fire control. You know, when the flames are screaming, it's, you know, you can sort of shout bonsai and charge in and work at it. It's exciting and you get your blood up. But when the flames are knocked down and the fire is what we would term contained or controlled, you still have to make sure that there's nothing in the fire area, or at least around the perimeter of the fire, that's going to have an opportunity to blow out maybe soon or the next day and start the fire up again. So there's a lot of it's just hard, back-breaking, dirty work, working around the edge of the fire, oftentimes with a back can and 50 pounds full, and digging up those spots and putting them out. And it's not fun. And, you know, people, when the fire gets knocked down, people like to kind of separate from the scene because they know what's coming next. And the ones that stick around and say, yeah, I'll help you with that, those are the ones you really appreciate.
Yeah.
But you got to do that well. And I had any ranger that works for a long period of time is going to have a fire that's been contained get away from them. And I had a couple too, and those are painful lessons, but you learn from them and you don't make those mistakes again.
You said the one thing you didn't want to have is that you put out a fire and then later that night or the next day, the fire's going again.
Yeah, the fire's going again, and the fire department gets called out, and these volunteers, these are not people that are getting paid to do a job like I am. They're volunteers, and they're pulled away from home or pulled away from dinner or pulled away from work, and they know that they're there because I didn't do my job well.
Yeah.
I didn't make sure that fire was adequately suppressed and mopped up, and when you're out there with them, yeah, they're very gracious about it. But as the ranger, you know, you feel it. I was kind of self-condemning more than they were. But but you learned to go to extreme measures to avoid that happening again, because these are the people that you work with, and you respect them, and they do good work, and you want to treat that offering, that volunteer effort, well and seriously, and not take advantage of it.
That mop-up reminded me of some fires that are really hard to clean up, and those are peat marsh fires.
Yeah.
There was one you wrote about that took place, I think it was around Middleton, Wisconsin. Was it Middleton or was it Verona? I've forgotten.
No, it was further east. It was, I think it was close to Watertown. I remember it was in the township of Lebanon. And I don't know if that's Jefferson County. I don't remember, but the town itself didn't have a fire department. But there was a fire department that we worked with, and you know, peat fires, peat soils, if you will, you know, which is like peat moss. You go to the garden store and buy a bag of peat moss. This is the kind of stuff that we're dealing with, and it burns, but it smolders more than it burns, and so there aren't open flames that you can see. There's just smoke, but those fires will, you know, peat moss can be, if it's really dry, is quite resistant to water. And the same is true out on a fire. And to get to a spot that may have burned 6 inches or 2 feet down into the peat, you have to get out there and dig it up and get right down to it and put water on it to get it out. And so the fire that I tell about in the book, I think we were there for 8 or 9 days going out. First thing in the morning, you go out at first light, because that was the only time there was no wind and you could see the little wisps of smoke, and we'd mark them with a very advanced material that we acquired called toilet paper.
And
we marked it with that, and then the rest of the day was spent, you know, going to that toilet paper and digging up and finding that hot spot and dumping water on it. And we did that for 9 days before we were satisfied that the fire was out.
Ron in La Crosse, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Ron.
Yes, I'm just calling, you know, hearing about, you know, preventing forest fires. And I know my brother back in 1965, I had one older brother, and he got a federally funded youth summer job program funded by federal government clearing brush in a local county park. And he and the other teenagers that worked that summer really enjoyed. Don said he really enjoyed that. But as our government and the Johnson administration got more involved in Vietnam, you know, and spent more money there than in the domestic programs, they cut funding for the summer job program. Well, the upshot of that is 4 years after Don was clearing brush in the county park here, he was clearing brush again in Vietnam. We had a draft back then, you know.
Yeah. Those were challenging days.
Yeah, they were indeed. Ron, thanks for sharing that. Appreciate it. It reminded, I don't know why, but it reminds me of, you know, there aren't a lot of, I mean, there. I'm sure there are people injured pretty often here in one way or another during a fire. You might get a little burn. You might fall and break a leg or whatever. There was one state forester in 1982, Don Eisberner.
Yes. Yeah.
You write about him.
Yeah. Yeah. That was pretty early. I started with the DNR in 1980, and I got to Spring Green in time for fire season in 81. And so I was pretty new. I was pretty green at this. And as I relate in the book, got a call one day at the end of the day, and you know, after some sort of chit chat, you know, my boss gently told me that a guy had been killed on a fire, and it was. Yeah, there were all sorts of reactions. One was just disbelief that this, you know, sort of, you know, fun, exciting, swashbuckling firefighting thing that I was doing. I mean, you knew there's a downside, but until it happens to one of your coworkers, you don't really appreciate it. And then to realize, you know, some of the details around what happened that resulted in his death was really sobering, and you could hear it in tones of voice on the radio, you know, the next day. Everybody was just kind of, oh, I don't know, they're just kind of tamped down. Their emotions were hit by this. That's the only firefighter we lost in the 30 years that I worked for DNR and fire. We other people died, but sometimes it was more medical stuff. There would, you know, there'd be people who'd have heart attacks like that.
Sure.
But this was strictly fire and
led to some protocol changes.
Because of it. Yeah, yeah. He was operating a piece of equipment that was different from the one he usually used, and the controls worked backwards. And so, when the fire came, and he went on instinct, he moved the controls the wrong way and stalled out the unit and got burned over.
Yeah, and that led to protocols that everybody had to have the same operating.
Everything, all the hydraulics were plumbed the same. Yeah, and that was it's a expensive way to learn a lesson, but the lesson was learned and action was taken to prevent that kind of thing happening again.
So, yeah. Oh, man. Talking today about the book, When the Smoke Clears, Stories and Reflections of a Wisconsin Forest Ranger. Blair Anderson is the author, and great to have him as our guest today. And you can join in. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. At WPR, we're committed to delivering high-quality programs from all over Wisconsin, and that's why we have news bureaus in your part of the state. Our local reporters keep us all connected, and you can support that essential service by joining in a special challenge. When 600 people donate before March 6th, a group of generous members will donate an extra $10,000 for WPR programs. You can give right now at WPR.org/donate. That's WPR.org/donate. Right now, we're talking with Blair Anderson about his book, When the Smoke Clears. Now, let's take some more calls. Karen in Madison will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Karen.
Oh, hi. I just wanted to say things that I heard in what you said. I'm curious about what you did before you became, you know, worked for a Fortune 500 company. I was touched by how in your job you learned so much about community connection and human beings. And that people that work with nature, they tend to be aware of nature's web and that everything is connected. And also even the caller that called about his brother being in Vietnam, and our country decided to spend dollars on Vietnam rather than, you know, really making the world a better place. And the only other thing I wanted to say is I really heard in your conversation education and how it's important to have a broad education, because then we can see how everything is connected, like in your rural sociology, and you know, and we—that's what the direction I believe that we need to take to really heal this planet, heal human beings. You know, our kids are very unwell from being so disconnected from the planet, and so on, and also seeing the forked tongue with which adults speak. One is of greed, and one is, I'm hoping the other is, you know, be well, do good works, and so on.
Well, yeah, we're an interesting species, aren't we? A lot of different things. I would wholeheartedly agree with your comments about education. Young people, I think, sometimes get in their minds that there's a certain thing that they want to do, and you know, maybe that's a genuine calling, and they should pursue that. But as you observe, Karen, education broadens one's perspective and helps you appreciate not only the things that you see, but maybe even things that you weren't aware were there. Like my epiphany about rural community when I came to Spring Green. There's a lot there, and it's good counsel for young folks, I think, to keep open minds and open eyes and you know, look into all sorts of different things, because you never know what's gonna stimulate you and move you to doing something interesting. I worked in downtown Chicago for a Fortune 500 company for 4 years, and I enjoyed it, but I didn't know what I didn't know, and I was fortunate enough to follow this circuitous path that led to Spring Green and get exposed to all the stuff that was so stimulating to me and was made for such a satisfying work career.
You talk about, I really did like that, and you would really enjoy, ma'am, that whole section in Blair's book about what goes into a community. You talked about integrity was one of the things. And you say born not of regulation or competition, but of relationships and reputation.
Yes. Yeah. You know, we make rules, and you're supposed to follow the rules. And if you don't, a bad thing can happen to you. And maybe that's a good way to learn. But the thing that so struck me in Spring Green, and we talked a little bit here today about the whole volunteer thing, but the idea that people in small towns you see the same people at the store, at the grocery store, at the hardware store, you know, at school, in church, and there's a more tacit understanding of the interrelationship between people. And When people see that and understand that, it's a better motivator for them to so-called do the right thing, because that becomes a function of all those interrelationships that you're involved in all aspects of your life with the same group of people in a small community like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a beautiful thing.
It is. Maya in Lone Rock, we'll go to you now. Hi, thank you for calling.
Well, thank you for having me. It's nice to hear Blair's voice. I commented that my husband read his book, and I am next in line to read it. I got to hear a bunch of the stories because my husband was excited about it when he was reading it. And I'm also going to comment the fact that what Blair was talking about being in a small town, Blair also was very instrumental in working in our local food pantry here, and his work has been a legacy for the rest of us that are still volunteering in that food pantry.
Oh, thank you for calling, Blair.
Yeah, thank you for your kind words. I appreciate that. I certainly spent a lot of time working with the folks from Lone Rock. You know, you're in that river bottom area where we have a lot of potential excitement with the pines and the pine lands there. And so it was a close community, part of our school district in River Valley and Spring Green. And so a lot of good connections there. I'm glad your husband enjoyed the stories, and I hope you enjoy them too when you get your turn at the book.
Yeah.
And thanks for your thoughts.
Yeah, thanks so much, Maya. And you eventually became an EMT for the community. You were elected to the school board.
Well, yeah, and that was part of a sort of a growing recognition. You know, we need to do things for each other. And I helped in the community, I suppose, through my professional work with the DNR. But that was a little different. That was my job. And I thought, well, you know, other people are doing this and that. And so I identified a couple of things to get involved in that I thought were ways that my background could help. And that was very encouraging to be able to do that and to kind of see how you help people.
Yeah. Carl in Barneveld, we'll go to you. Hi, Carl.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. And I just wanted to say another legacy that Blair left. He helped me with, I've got 40 acres of land here that was 40 acres basically of thistles, and we transformed it into a forest. I remember Blair coming out and telling me about his history when he was inspecting the little seedlings and how, as an accountant, everything was black and white. And with forestry, it's not the same.
Yeah.
Professionally, I worked with him at Blue Mountain State Park where we did an experimental seeding. Instead of planting trees at a tree planter, we broadcast acorns over an old field, and that is now a forest, too. So he's leaving a legacy of trees behind, too.
Well, good. Again, thank you for those kind words. It's a satisfying line of work to be involved in, because there are a lot of positive success kinds of stories that come from them, as you mentioned. And one of the cool things is that, you know, those trees in that forest will be there long after I'm gone.
Yeah. Thank you, Carl.
Yeah, that was great.
And Lanny in Ashland. Hi, Lanny.
Well, hello. How are you guys?
Good.
Yep. We're good.
Good. I just want to comment, I come from a big city, too. I live in Ashland, Wisconsin, which is way up north. I'm on Lake Superior Bay, actually, and I got a nice apartment here. But I'd like to just thank that gentleman there, the DNR guy, because I remember when I was growing up, we didn't really like the DNR because we got in a little trouble. But when you get older, you kind of respect that.
We talked about this kind of at the outset of the show. A lot of folks of the DNR are involved in regulation, and if you run afoul of that, and that's one of your first exposures to the DNR, mm-hmm. you can take a not the most positive perspective on it.
Well, your book is so filled. We haven't even touched on all the stories in the book, and I hope a lot of people get a chance to read it, Blair. It's been a real pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much, and thanks for writing the book.
Well, thank you, Larry. I appreciate all the good news and good information that you share with the good people of Wisconsin here.
Yeah, Blair Anderson authored When the Smoke Clears, Stories and Reflections of a Wisconsin Forest Ranger. You'll learn a lot, and you'll have some good laughs, too, along the way when you read his book. It was a real pleasure for me to talk with him and to read the book. And a pleasure with our team as well. We got a good team for you. Lee Rayburn, Jeff Robbins, our technical directors, Claire Kniper, Joel Patnott, our producers, Jill Nadeau, our executive producer. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots more in store on WPR News.